an interview with Dr. Harold Rush in his office at the top of the McArdle Laboratory. The date is the 9th of June, 1982. I'm Laura Smale. And my first question to you, Dr. Rush, is since this is just a supplement to the very complete history you've written of the McArdle Lab and of the Clinical Science Center, and also of your own life to some extent, I'd like to know why you wrote that.
The reason I wrote it is because I received a letter, as all professors do, about the time of to retire, requesting that any interesting information, letters, reports that have been received or sent out during one's tenure in the university, that those should be sent to the university archives. When I retired, I started to collect this material, and then realized that it would probably be put in boxes and filed away, and perhaps no one would ever look at it. So I decided that a summary of the material would be interesting, maybe a 10-page summary. Well, I started writing this summary, and before I knew it, I was way beyond the 10 pages, and it I began writing it in first person, because I was so intimately involved from the very beginning. And after I had maybe 50 pages or so, I thought, well, this is more than a summary. This I might as well go whole hog and write a rather detailed account of how the two cancer centers at Wisconsin, how they started and their early period, because now I'm the only one around who was here for the beginning, or indeed the preliminaries of the two cancer centers. And by that I mean the McArdle Laboratory for Cancer Research and the Clinical Cancer Research Center. So that's, I enjoyed doing this because I didn't want to just quit as soon as I retired. I wanted something to do, and this was rather enjoyable for me to review the past and reminisce on what went on and look up the exact details, because I had I learned as I went along that I was off by as much as a year on what happened at a particular time, and it was only when I verified it by going through notes. Fortunately, I've kept a diary ever since I guess I started medical school, or maybe even a freshman in college, so I could refer to the diary for exact dates when this or that happened.
And that's interesting. A personal at-home diary or at work diary?
A personal diary that, but it was mainly, well, it was a little of each, personal things. When my children were growing up, made comments about that. But also, I always noted the things that were, you might say, more than milestones, but various events, certain people visiting the laboratory, and when I would be busy writing on applications and that type of thing. So that was all in the diary.
Hmm. That makes you unusual already.
Well, I don't know what will happen
in terms of writing.
Yes. It's not a diary that people would just get a great deal of joy reading, because it's pretty set, mentioning various exact things that happened without too much comment. Mm-hmm. And little or no philosophy or that type of thing.
What made you decide to keep a diary?
I don't know. I guess I'm just a methodical person, and like to keep track of when things happened. I certainly didn't start out with the idea that this diary would be of any interest to anyone other than perhaps my children and grandchildren, and that's about it. I didn't write it for posterity because it isn't that type.
You say you started it when you were in college?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, do you remember what?
I think I started it when I was a freshman, but I haven't gone back to look that far. These are all in boxes, and when I started writing this history, I just dug back to the time that I started medical school, I believe, and didn't look in the other box where there were other diaries. So
you're an historian, and clearly you must have had an interest, because lots of people, everyone you say is given that suggestion when they retire.
Yes.
But not everyone settles down and decides to use the time writing up a history.
Well, I hardly classify myself as a historian, but I must say that of the reading that I have done, which is somewhat limited other than science, I don't get to read novels and that type of thing as much as I would like. And what I have read all this time has, on the outside, has usually been historical articles. And I appreciate not the textbook histories, but articles written by the people who were there. For instance, just one thing came to mind. I read a book called A Trip Around the World by William Dampier, who was a privateer and then became a pirate and did go around the world from 1670 to 1690, and it's an excellent account. And that type of book, where the person was there who saw it, and to me is more interesting than rehash of what has must be put together in a more condensed versions. So, and I have enjoyed reading history, and I've always thought when I retired that my chief reading would be along those lines.
How did you get onto that and to this to Dampier?
I received advertisements from I can't think of the company, the publisher now, that sends around ads for rather unusual books. Dover Publishing.
Oh, yes.
Dover Publishing.
They have a good list.
Yes. So I saw those lists, and I ordered a couple of the books or several of the books that they put out, or reprints of very old things that have gone out of print.
You'll have to get into all the Antarctica exploration diaries. They're simply fascinating.
Yes.
You know, the 1903 and 1910. And
yeah. I must do that. But since I retired, not only writing the history, but I know so many other things have come up that I really haven't had the time to do these things that I always say, well, I'm going to do that after I finish this or after I finish that. And I hope that, well, I've been blessed with good eyesight thus far, and I hope that continues, because I do want to get to reading a number of these things. And fortunately, my memory is reasonable, so that I don't forget it after I've read one page. I don't forget what I've read. And of course, that may disappear too after a few years. So I have to crowd many of these desires of mine into the next few years as rapidly as I can.
That figures that if you like to read history, that's why you like to write it. The practical question I have to ask you is about your view of the various presidents of the university in terms of how they assisted your work.
Yes.
You personally, and the research organizations that you headed, and you spoke of. Did you have anything to do with Frank? With Glenn Frank?
No, I really. I think I met Mr. Frank on one or two occasions, but I was influenced by him in as much that he was an outstanding orator. And in those days, when I was a student here, he gave talks from time to time that were attended as sort of an assembly. It was just marvelous to sit and hear him talk about a number of things. I don't remember too much now what they were, but where I was very, very impressed was in 1936, when I was a cancer fellow, but before I really had anything to do with organizing the cancer center, there was a cancer symposium. And this came about because of the money from the Bowman Fund.
Yeah. I think you talk about that.
Yes,
in the book.
I have that in the book. Mm-hmm. But the fascinating part is that to hear these people who came from the outside, who were really the leaders in their field, but the introduction to the whole symposium was given by Mr. Frank, and that introduction, I'll never forget the gist of the whole thing. I can't remember, obviously, all the details, but I remember he said that cancer was the most hideously persistent and the most persistently hideous of all diseases. And those are just a couple of words that I remember. The whole speech was filled with that type of forceful expression. Mm-hmm. By the time he got through with giving his, I would say it was a 15 or 20 minute talk that spurred us all on to get out and kill the dragon, I was ready to grab the sword and slay the cancer dragon. It was so mm-hmm. impressive. And that's really all that I had to do with President Frank in terms of any direct contact. I remember he also, when the symposium, the last day of the symposium, we were invited, the speakers who were all older and well-known were invited to his house for a reception, and I was also invited, and that's the first time I'd been invited to the president's house, and I was impressed, and my ego was inflated by being included with these people. Mm. So, and then the next Dykstra came next, and I didn't really have, I had very little contact with Dykstra, and the main reason is that at that time, Mr. Fred was dean of the graduate school. And he also, as dean, was on the Committee on Cancer, which Glenn Frank had set up when the Bowman money became available. That was in 1935, 34, 35. And Mr. Fred and Dean Middleton and I think Dr. Meek was also on that committee, were the cancer committee. So during this period from when I became a cancer fellow in July 1935, I would go to two people to ask for funds and help and aid. No, three people. One was Professor Meek, who was my mentor. When I was instructor in physiology from 1944 until 35, and Dr. Meek was head of
44 to.
Let's see, September 44 to July 45. I'm sorry, 30. I'm sorry, I should say, I take all this back if
it's
I said 40. It's 34.
Oh, that's because I thought you said 30. Okay.
Yeah, well, to 35. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I was an instructor in physiology. Dr. Meek was head of the department. Mm-hmm. From 35 until 40, when the McArdle was built, I was a cancer fellow, and I would continue going to Dr. Meek for advice, but also to Mr. Fred, because he was dean of the graduate school and had some funds which they made available. This was really very small amounts, probably $100 at a time, and also to Dr. Middleton, who was dean of the medical school. So those were the three people that I saw very frequently, who guided and gave me inspiration.
So you could go straight to Fred, the dean of the graduate school?
Yes.
Even though you were comparatively young?
Yes. In those days, there weren't as many people going to the dean requesting money, and he was always very enthusiastic about what might could be done in the cancer field, and was extremely encouraging about wanting to help, and as I say, giving small grants. And as I remember, he just did this on his own. I don't believe there was a research committee. If there was at that time, I never was aware of them. I also would get some money from Dr. Meek, who was in physiology, but that money would be in very small amounts. But he furnished eventually three rooms in the physiology department for my work. And also part of an animal room up on the top floor of the Service Memorial Institute. Dr. Middleton also provided a little money. He was always more cautious than Dean Fred about handing money, because he didn't have as much to.
Was Fred personally friendly to you? Did you feel you
yes.
got to know him?
Yes, I got to know him very well. And he was extremely encouraging. He'd always ask me how things were going, and whether I had made any important discoveries since the last time I saw him. And I suppose I saw him about once a month at least. And then
was
before,
that sort of a jovial remark?
Yes. Well, then before I'd be all set to tell him about what had happened. But before I'd get one or two sentences out, he'd start on something else. So I never really got to talk to him.
Everybody says that.
Yeah.
When he asks them a question and they start to answer, then he starts talking about something else.
That's right. But he seemed, at the same time, he seemed to know what was going on. Of course, I had written reports that would go to the three people, Meek, Middleton, and Fred. So he probably knew what was going on from looking at those written reports rather than what I told him.
But you felt that he had read them and that he did keep...
Oh, he must have, because he seemed to know what was going on. And as I say, he never gave me any chance to talk for any length of time about what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
He is a great fellow. I enjoyed him.
So you must have been glad when he was made president.
Oh, yes, yes. Then I didn't see him as often about getting funds, or not at all about getting funds, but I would see him quite often. I was on the research committee for a while, for 3-4 years, I guess, and that was when Fred became president, Elvium was made dean of the graduate school, and was head of the research committee, so occasionally Fred would come into the room when we were discussing research applications, and I would see him then, and sometime he just invited me out to just have a brief chat while he was president. The one of the things that I remember very well about President Fred, or actually when President Fred retired, and all along, as I have already stated, he was very interested in cancer research and what we were doing. And after he retired as president, he knew that we were getting short of space in that what we call Old McArdle, which was situated on Charter Street. And one day he was aware of this, and one day he came over and he said, "Harold, why don't you have more, why don't you work on getting more space for cancer research?" And I said, "Well, we do need more space, but why didn't you say this to me while you were president?" And he said, "Well, I was so busy then that I didn't have time, but now I think you need more space." As a result of that, a small committee was named, I guess by President Elvium, and this small committee with representatives from various of the biological fields, people who were working on, you might say, growth-related subjects, met, and they all agreed that more space was needed because all of them would like to have more space.
You must have gone into this.
Yeah, and I've gone into that in quite some detail in the history. Yeah.
All right. Well, how do you saw Elvium and Fred then in the same positions as both as graduate dean and as president? How would you compare them?
Elvium was more direct and got to the core of the problem very rapidly, and when he'd ask a question, he would expect a direct answer and wouldn't interrupt. He was also very concerned and interested in what we were doing at McArdle. One reason, I'm sure, is beside the work we were doing, but his either the first or second graduate student of his was Van Potter, and of course Van Potter was one of our very leading lights at McArdle, and at Boutwell, and the Millers had both come from the biochemistry department, so he had a fatherly interest and a sense of wanting to see the graduates of that department do well, and they did do well. So. Also, for a while, Fred Stair was one of his graduate students. I'm not certain at the moment whether Fred Stair got his PhD before Potter or not, but they were both, I think, the two earliest graduate students of Elvium. So this gave him a very keen interest in what we were doing.
Did you need Fred's help at all when you were applying for, I guess you hadn't done it by that time, applying for larger amounts of money from outside?
I think I should go back and say that they, when the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda was founded in 1937, it wasn't known exactly how they would spend the money. They used some of the money to put up a institute there, a building, but then there was also money that was to be distributed to various universities throughout the country. Both President Fred, or at that time he was he was dean of the graduate school, and Dean Middleton had correspondence with the national, with the board, or rather the National Cancer Council, the Council of the National Cancer Institute, to inquire just how the money that they had could would be distributed. And I have letters that they have written to some of the directors or the members of that committee to inquire whether the money was available now or at that time or when it would become available. And I know that that President Fred, or then as I say he was Dean, went to Washington to inquire about this on a couple occasions, and Dr. Middleton went one time to inquire.
Did you have a hand in that? I mean, did you tell them that this was happening and that there would be money, might be money, and they should write about it?
I knew that this was happening, and I encouraged this, but actually Mr. Fred was very well acquainted with it because he went to Washington quite frequently and knew some of the members of this National Cancer Advisory Committee, or Advisory Council it was called. So he was better acquainted with the actual details of what might be going on than I was. And at that time I was more of a bystander, just hoping that that he and Middleton would do these things, but I didn't have any direct correspondence myself at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next, after Elvium died, my contact with Harrington was less than with the Fred or Elvium, mainly because he was not a scientist, but I'd known Mr. Harrington from back years before he became president, when I was first married and my children and the family lived on Regent Street out across the road from the cemetery, and the Harringtons lived up on, I believe it's called Ridge Road, which was about two or three blocks from where we lived, and he had some of his daughters were the age of my daughters, so they would stop by on the way to school or on the way home from school, that is the ones who were of the age. So we knew one another, and as parents of children who were the same age.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I also appreciated hearing his lectures over TV on history. He was certainly an excellent lecturer, and my interest in history too fit in with what he had
when
to say.
When did you have time to, were they in the evening?
I believe some of them were in the evening or at noon hour. I don't remember for certain just when, and I didn't hear all of them. I regretted that I didn't hear all of his lectures. So when he became president, we were old friends, but I didn't have the same contact with him that I had with the previous presidents.
Mm-hmm.
With President Young, Chancellor, that's
yes.
Right, Chancellor Young, again reestablished a closer relationship because of his interest in research, cancer research. I don't believe I went up to see him too often about what we were doing, but we were friends from in other ways. I remember one time we went fishing together. It was a practice of for maybe 10 years, a group of friends and I would go up to Canada fishing. This group was Dr. Carreri and Dr. Ansfield, they were really the two standbys then there would always be three or four extra to make a make it inexpensive enough to charter a plane to fly up to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And one time, Chancellor Young, I don't remember exactly how he got involved, but who mentioned this to him, but he came along with us. I think there were six of us that flew up to Canada. And I didn't know whether he was an experienced fisherman or not. We were talked about other things. And I remember the first, there were three of us in a boat up on these very wild lakes or in a place that you could only get to by float plane. We started out one morning. Usually we'd fish for either northerns or walleyes, and we got in a place, you get to know where there may be walleyes, and I began telling him about how to go about fishing for walleyes, and before I caught one, he had about three. So I kept still, and I said, well, had you been fishing before? Which was a really dumb question, because he's very experienced fisherman.
I suppose knew, being from Maine, he must have had plenty
that's
of
right,
chance.
That's right, and he knew much more about it. Well, this became sort of a joke because he took it good-naturedly, mm-hmm. and I got over my embarrassment in a hurry. So, but then I guess so far as the cancer research is concerned, in 1971, when the National Cancer Act was passed, one of the items was that there were to be 15 new comprehensive cancer centers. Now, McArdle was a very well-known cancer center, but it's what was called a specialized cancer center because they were involved only in basic research. A comprehensive center was one which was to be carry on basic research, clinical research, and be involved with treating cancer patients. Congress felt that there had been enough research going on, or not enough, but at least that more practical approach to the cancer problem should take place. So then President or Chancellor Young asked me whether I felt that there should be a comprehensive cancer center on the campus.
Oh, and you mean he called you into his office? And
I don't remember the details, but anyway, I guess I must have gone up there, and I said, yes, I thought we should have a comprehensive center. I'd already discussed this with, part of it, with Dr. Pito, who was acting dean of the medical school, and with Dr. Johnson, who was, Robert Johnson, who was acting head of the Clinical Cancer Center, which had been under the direction of Dr. Carreri for many years. Mm-hmm. And all of us agreed that this would be a good idea. And I don't know whether Dr. Pito called Young first or just how this came about, but anyway, this was called to Young's attention, and then he asked me whether I felt we should have one, and I said yes. He said, well, would I be willing to be a director? At that time, I was 62 years of age, and one can, supposedly, the rule are that you can serve as an officer or a dean or a director of the university until you're 65, and I said that it wouldn't be possible to be director and accomplish very much in 3 years. So he said, well, they would, if my health was good, I could be reappointed as director each year. So I said, well, under those conditions, I would accept this and take on the task of building up and organizing the Comprehensive Cancer Center. So in that way, Ed Young played a key role in encouraging this venture to get underway.
You must have been a very good administrator. I mean, you, after all, got several of these things going and seem to have... Did you then look at other administrators, like the presidents and chancellors, and think that they might have done things better?
Not in the beginning. I always had the idea that an administrator should, first of all, get good people. Well, first decide on what subject matter should be studied, and then get the very best people who were available to head up the particular project. And perhaps if I've done anything is to select, or in the beginning, when I was really the only one who made the decision for some of the early people, although I had help from advice from others later on, of course, from the whole department, but in the beginning, in getting Potters and the Millers and Boutwell, I was really the only one, and Jerry Mueller, I was really the only one at that time to make the decision. And then after one has good people, to do everything you can to make life happy and comfortable, to provide a good environment for them to work in, and to put one's own research as a secondary item. I feel that a director of a science laboratory should also be doing research, because in that way you have an appreciation of what others are doing and you're better able to judge what they're doing. But that your own research should not be the foremost, that should work for the other people. Also, I think that to encourage a interchange of ideas among the people. In general, people don't flourish if they're on their own and working in a isolated area. This isolated area could be in a huge building where you don't have contact with others, or it could be out in a small university in an isolated place. So we had frequent weekly meetings of the department.
You said that once before, but you said also that it wasn't a good idea to have too many people doing research in the same place.
Yes, what I meant by saying that is that I don't believe in having huge institutions of the type that some of them are huge, because the director cannot know what's going on in an intimate way. So I think that it's better to have 10 institutions, let's say the size of McArdle, than one institution as large as 10 McArdles. Mm-hmm. Numbers of people and square footage does not necessarily make may even hinder a good cancer center.
Excuse me, I interrupted you. You were saying that at meetings.
Yes, I think it's very important for the people to, the heads of various groups to get together once a week and discuss their problems receive and accept and encourage constructive criticism from the others in the group, because no one can think of all the answers or the problems that arise, so it's important to get suggestions from your fellow men. And in this regard, the people here have always cooperated and gotten along very well in getting suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Are you watching the Oppenheimer film?
Yes, I am.
It must be very similar method of work.
Unfortunately, I missed some of the key parts of it, but I think there, as I gather, you had the same type of enthusiasm of people working together and with enthusiasm and helping and assisting one another to accomplish a goal. So and it's similar.
I I wanted to ask you, what is the severest problem for cancer research now, whether either in the university or nationally or both?
I would say maybe a lack of sufficient good ideas. There are many good ideas, but unfortunately, we don't yet know which is the best direction or the best idea that should be followed with the most money and the most vigor and the most assistance. In the beginning, we had to try many attacks in different areas. Today, it's narrowing down, and I think that's very helpful. I think that the knowledge about how cancer is formed, both by chemicals and viruses, recently, as an example, there has been a virus isolated that does cause human cancer, a type of leukemia that's quite rare, but nevertheless, this is a very important step, and an idea that had been thought of as that leukemia probably was a viral disease and thought of for many, many years, but it's been extremely difficult to prove. We knew that many animal tumors and tumors of fowls are caused by viruses, but to pin this down with in people was another story. That has now been done, and that's very helpful, and will lead to a great deal more intensified research in the area. Another area that's an old idea, which is now coming to be more encouraging, was the idea that one could target a particular cancer-killing material, target that directly to a cancer cell. I remember we talked about this 30 years ago, or even 40 years ago, but the techniques weren't really available to do it. Many attempts were tried, but it was always more of a type of shotgun approach rather than narrowing in with a rifle approach. But recently, by making monoclonal antibodies to a specific type of tumor, these monoclonal antibodies, people are now putting on chemotherapeutic agents on those, and hopefully to zero in on the cancer cell without harming other cells. This is in a very experimental stage, but they at least it's getting closer to solving the problem. So now those are examples of two types of approaches that can receive much more fundamental and meaningful type of research. There are others too, that for instance, the Millers, with all of the work they've done on chemical carcinogenesis, have shown that certain enzymes that are involved with changing a chemical to a carcinogen have been very helpful in understanding of how chemicals produce cancer, and why they do in some people, and why they don't in others.
Do you still go to the meetings?
Yes, I I go to the seminars on the Friday noon discussion at McArdle, and I go to the various seminars in the clinical center, and I also have been going to the annual meeting of the Association, American Association for Cancer Research. This last April, the last week of April, I attended the 75th anniversary of the American Association of Cancer Research, and along with two other people who were some of the older members, like I am, of that association, we each gave a talk on some of the early days of cancer research.
Did you write that up?
Yes, I wrote it up, but this was given in a 25-minute presentation, and it was taped, so that's they have it on tape, but I also...
And you told some amusing stories that you were going to include in it.
Right.
I was hoping you had a copy of it.
Yeah, I do have a copy. And so that was an interesting session, too.
And you still feel on top of what's going on in cancer research?
I couldn't say that I feel on top of it, because the advances come very rapidly, and it's difficult to have an in-depth knowledge of the various fields. So, no, I can't stay on top of it. I know in a general way what's going on, but the details I've lost out on, and I think this is not unusual, because most fields, specialized areas of science, advance so rapidly that I think if you don't read the new articles within 6 months, you're sort of out of the field. So I can talk to the people. I understand what they're saying.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah,
you
understand.
Can still understand what they
yes,
say.
Yes.
Do you, if you look back over what you've done, what do you regard as most important?
I would say the getting good people together, and then letting them run the show, and above all, asking for and accepting their suggestions, and working together as a team, rather than being dictatorial. I don't know whether any directors are dictatorial I know they were in the past, but this has to be a team effort, and you must rely on the top-notch people that you've selected, because they know more about the area than you possibly could know.
But how do you compare that to, for instance, serving on some of the national committees and making some of the, being in on some of the big decisions that were made about financing research?
Yeah, that's at a different level of deciding on the particular types of areas that should receive support. As an example, how much money might be used, what percentage of the money might be used for construction of new centers, or what percentage for fellowships, or how much for in-house that's used in Washington, or for extramural, which is at an entirely different level.
But I mean, you were there. Do you think you had an influence on the kinds of decisions that were made, or
well,
not?
Well, I would say there were about 15 people on the when I first served on the National Advisory Cancer Council. And from 54 to 58, and then again on a National Cancer Advisory Board, which had changed its name from 72 to 74, and again there were about 15 people who would be present. There were maybe 20, a total of 20 people. So I would say I had about 1/15 say, and I would express my views. And they would be intermingled with other views, and then these would finally come out with a decision. I think I had most to do when I would be chairman of a committee or a subcommittee. As an example, I was chairman of the subcommittee of the board that had to do with cancer centers, and that is comprehensive cancer centers. So. As chairman, I had quite a bit to do with what the criteria should be.
Yes, that would be.
But maybe a fifth of what, because there are five of us on there, and a fifth, say.
I'd like to ask you, this is just at the end of the tape, what, as a scientist, is you think is the major problem in the facing the world today?
I think the major problem is coming to some agreement on trying to prevent war and people fighting. I don't have any good ideas of how this should come about. But if we can live peacefully and spend more money on things that we would like to do, then we'd all be a lot happier. But it's not an easy problem.
Have you been active in any of the organizations that are the Physicians for Social Responsibility or anything?
No, I haven't. I just haven't had time, and I've felt that this is such a complicated problem, and people fight among themselves, some people as individuals and as groups, and I just wish I knew some secret formula of how to get people working together nationally as a whole. Scientists of all countries meeting together get along very well and have excellent discussions in science, and even if you discuss politics, scientists more or less agree, or if they disagree, they don't say very much. If they're very far apart, like usually the Russian scientists don't like to get into to discussion, to my knowledge, at least the ones I've talked to. We had a Russian here in 1964, spent about 6 months with us here at McCardle, and all the time he was here, we were very friendly, but I did not broach the subject of politics with him. Because I didn't want to embarrass him. And I remember one time, though, he brought up the subject. I was complaining because as time went on, more red tape was brought into the picture than in the university to have something done than was true in the past. We had to have a wall, a very small wall put up, dividing a whole room into two smaller rooms, and it took about 8 months to accomplish this. Oh. 10 years before that could be done within a week. And I mentioned this to the fellow. I said, you know, there's all this red tape that's going on, and he said, oh, he said, you know, that's getting just like it was, like it is in Russia. So, and we both had a good laugh about this. But
do you correspond with him?
No, I don't. I would, for a while we did. But again, I always felt that I might embarrass him by corresponding. And I sent him journals that he wanted to have for a while. And he was head of the Institute for Antibiotics. And during the war, he was in charge of the Russians getting out such antibiotics as penicillin and similar types of things. And then after the war, he felt that you could probably make antibiotics against cancer. Mm-hmm. So that was his main interest. And when he came here, it wasn't to do research, it was to write up this work in solitude. And as a matter of fact, he occupied the office right next door here on the 11th floor, and spent most of his time writing.
I gather he didn't achieve anything. Antibiotics are not used against cancer.
No, that's correct. And some you might say are antibiotics, yes, are used as chemotherapeutic agents, but they haven't done as well as he had hoped they might, and as well as others had hoped might be the case.
Well, this is close to the end of the tape, and thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, and if people want more details, they can read the history.
Yes, I hope the book will be available, and there'll be a copy for the archives.
Yes, there certainly will.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.